The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Edinburgh Books Podcast. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This is the weekend when the centrepiece of the festival unfolds. It's the International Writers' Conference, which over the next 5 days will debate the state and future of fiction. No small subject there. It's a restaging of an event from 1962, when many of the greats and still to become greats found themselves locked in literary brawl, literally in the case of some of those present. Jim Haynes was one of the masterminds, and he explained to Tim Mabey what it was all about.
At the time, I felt it was very important. It added a new element to the festival. I think a much needed, well, as we see now, much appreciated and needed element to the festival. The only thing different then and now is that there was less emphasis then on the writer's output. It was more a discussion on his or her ideas. People weren't plugging their merchandise, so to speak. It was more idealistic, I guess, and much more anarchistic and freewheeling and anything goes attitude to the people on the stage and, of course, to the organizers, John and I.
And was there an awful lot of heckling going on?
No heckling didn't exist at all, but there was a lot of notes. We encouraged and solicited notes from the audience. So notes went up to the chairman every day, whoever the chairman was, whatever the topic was. People in the audience wanting further elaboration or asking a particular writer a question or whatever. So it was a dialogue.
It was also significant, I understand, that it launched the career of quite a number of major writers.
It definitely put William Burroughs on the map. Mary McCarthy, and particularly Mary McCarthy, but I think Norman Mailer also praised Burroughs at the conference highly. And Burroughs was not exactly a household name in 62, and became overnight someone that all the world's publishers wanted to know. You know, who is this guy and who is Mary McCarthy praising him? And you know,
there's so many names who were there, it's almost a surprise that you managed to gather them. Was that just word of mouth?
I always say that one of the things that a good producer does, it's a little bit a petty larceny in a way. You call up Olivier and you say, Olivier, you're interested in doing this Broadway show? I've got Marilyn Monroe. She's agreed. And he said, oh, you got Marilyn Monroe? Okay, you can count me in. You call up Marilyn Monroe and you say, I've got Olivier. And there was a little bit of that, you know. We had Lawrence Durrell because a doctor friend of his lived in Edinburgh, was a friend of mine, lived right around the corner from me. So we got Lawrence Durrell, and that made it easy to get Miller. And once we had Miller, that opened the door to Mailer. We talk about John Calder and myself, but we were really a troika. It was Sonia Orwell as well, was the third person. And Sonia, who had been Cyril Connolly's secretary and knew everyone and was, I mean this in a flattering, not unflattering way, she was a bit of a literary and intellectual snob. And she got her chums. So we're doing a party in Edinburgh, come. And so she got Mary McCarthy, she got Norman Mailer, she got Angus Wilson, you know, and then that meant we got Colin McInnes, and, you know. And
in a sense, though, you were, as you said before, an anarchist bunch. You were not the establishment at all.
No, not at all, not at all. We were complete outsiders. I mean, here I was, a young American bookseller in Edinburgh, and John was a Canadian Scottish publisher in London. We weren't part of any literary establishment anywhere, really. I mean, John was publishing avant-garde French novels more than anything else, and I had created a bookshop in Edinburgh, which was quite an oasis, but definitely wasn't involved in the literary establishment of Scotland or Edinburgh at the time. I was definitely an outsider, even though people liked the bookshop. I was definitely an outsider. And in a way, this added to the occasion. You know, who are these two upstarts, or three upstarts? I always neglect to mention Sonia's amazing role, Sonia Harwell, great lady who's not with us anymore.
You are the establishment now, aren't you? I believe they're putting up a sculpture outside that bookshop as positioned where it was.
Yes, that's a very humbling and exciting concept. I just talked to the university a few minutes ago. It's going up next Wednesday afternoon. So it'll be... I haven't seen it yet. I have no idea. Apparently, they had a competition between the... organized by the University of Edinburgh and Edinburgh College of Art, and narrowed down to two winners. I don't know how many people submitted, but they're using both proposals. I'm not going to get one sculpture, I'm getting two sculptures.
But they're not representational, are they?
I was walking down Princess Street shortly after I'd opened the bookshop, and there's a men's club, which is something like the Garrick, but it's called the New Club in Edinburgh. And out of the New Club came two workmen carrying a rhinoceros head. And I said to the workers, what are you doing with that rhinoceros head? They said, we're disposing of it. Do you want it? And I said, yes. So that became the symbol of my bookshop. So I think rhinoceros head is going to be one of the sculptures. But I haven't seen them yet, so I don't know.
Now things have moved on so much. It would be interesting, I mean, to know what you think is most significant about the literary culture. Because it's worldwide now, isn't it?
Yesterday I heard someone say to me, I said that writers as a profession is such a solitary role. You're home in front of a computer or a typewriter or whatever, and that a conference or book festival allows them to meet the public. I think everyone likes feedback, no matter what subject what do you do. And writers specifically, I think, craving. I mean, the only feedback they had before was literary criticism of some kind or another, somebody writing a review or something like that. But now they can get direct feedback, people, you know, signing their books and talking to them and everything. And I think that's very important.
And that's very much the spirit of your arts lab that you set up in London, isn't it?
The arts lab. It's a good old arts lab. You remember the arts lab? Yeah, it was wonderful. The arts lab was a It was a place where I tried to establish a policy of never saying the word no. You know, I remember two dancers from Buenos Aires arrived and said we wanted to put on an experimental ballet. And I said, well, the only time the theater's available is at midnight. And the dancers looked at each other and me, and they said, well, will anyone come at midnight? And I said, well, let's try, let's see. And it was a hit. And at midnight, taxis were pulling up from all over London to see their show. Graciela Martinez. I don't know if you remember Graciela Martinez.
Vaguely.
Yeah.
In that sense, you know, you are part of the way things have developed, aren't you? Don't you feel?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the things that I appreciated at the time, and I think it's important today, is to use space that becomes available to create something in that space. I mean, the original Traverse, well, the original bookshop was a junk shop. The original Traverse was a flop house. The Arts Lab was, of course, a couple of warehouses in London and Covent Garden. And from that sprang, and I don't know if it's still ongoing because I live in Paris now, but it, in a way it does. It happened in Paris and it happened in Amsterdam. Is people finding spaces and buildings that are not being used, and converting them, and converting the theater, and converting a gallery space, converting, you know, tea room, and, you know, creating spaces. And I think that's very important. You don't have to build a $500,000 building to house a theater. You can find a theater that space is not being used and just put a few thousand dollars into the production. You don't need big money.
You're the man who curates the artists as well as being an artist yourself. And yet people like you have managed to bring the people who live ordinary lives and straight lives and very established lives to kind of appreciate the arts much in a much more wide way. Would you think that's a fair description?
I even go further, and I go so far that it's almost off the edge of the plate. I don't even use the words arts anymore. It's finished. I just think it's everything is information. Everybody's producing information, and you elect the medium you want to use, whether it's dance or theater or literature or, you know, a film or whatever, and we're all producing information, and sometimes it's relevant to you and sometimes it's not, and sometimes it's meaningful to you and sometimes it's not, and it doesn't make any difference.
And for you, who are the important artists, authors, creative people today, the most important?
I like the late, great Christopher Hitchens a lot. You know, I like the late, great Gore Vidal, who just died recently. I like essayists a lot. I like to read essays, and I like the essayist who takes a subject and meanders around it and puts their own personal elements from their own life into the essay and everything. Kapuscinski was another one, the Polish journalist. Mailer, of course, did it. My own favorite writer is someone I read when I was a teenager in America, is Henry Miller. And I read Henry Miller when I was in my teens in Louisiana. And I read him again in my 20s in Edinburgh, again in my 30s in London, and my 40s in Paris. And the book is the same book. I read all his books, but the one I'm talking about is Tropic of Cancer. And the book is the same in all four time periods, but I was a different person in all four time periods, and therefore, for me, it was a different book. I mean, in a way, just like, which is, I think is the power of Durrell's Alexander Quartet. You know, you see all these different angles from different perspectives, and it's the same story or it's the same information, but you're getting it differently, and I found that very exciting and meaningful.
And are you having time to do any work these days?
I wrote a book against work, so I never work. I created a new verb, to fuller, in honor of Bucky Fuller. If you like what you're doing, you're fullering. And I honestly contend, that all people in the information industry, which is journalists, publishers, writers, teachers, filmmakers, television people, theater people, actors. Well, the information is vast. I contend that none of those people are working. They're all fullering. And the first reward for fullering is the joy of doing it. You're lucky to be able to do it. The first payment is the mere fact that you're doing it. And the second payment can be remunerated in various ways, but
thank you very much indeed, and yeah. I really hope you enjoy your conference.
Oh, well, I enjoy my 56th Edinburgh Festival. I've been 56 years in a row, and 10 years living here from 56 to 66. And then after 66, I lived in London and Amsterdam and Paris, and I always come back. Well, actually, you never go back anywhere. I come forward to Edinburgh.
The first of the five addresses is being given by the Egyptian novelist Adaf Swaif. You can find the full text of her speech on the website. But the Writers' Conference is not the only event going on at the moment, nor is Adaf Swaif the only voice from the Middle East. Raja Shehadeh talked to us about his occupation diaries, written from inside Palestine.
And it covers the last 2 years, and my life. I am a compulsive diary writer. I've been writing diary for 44 years. And the book is selections from the diaries of the last 2 years, which, of course, cover very important events, the Arab Spring, the bid to the statehood, Palestinian bid to statehood, and what this meant to people in the occupied territories. Of course, as my other books are, it's a very personal book, and I speak a lot about my father and mother. I discovered after my mother's death that she had kept a diary of her years in Jaffa, because this is where she was born and grew up, and the diaries are for the years 44 and 45, just before she got married. So I use some of these diaries in this book and write about her and about my father and the difficulties they went through, which unfortunately have not ended for me. My life has been full of wars and conflict, and the diaries are my way of managing my anger and trying to live a life that is meaningful and contributing to the resistance as well as to literature, as well as to the end of the conflict.
And with the maelstrom that has, in the last 18 months, hit the whole of the Middle East, have you, as Palestinians, felt forgotten a bit?
We will never be forgotten, because the Palestinian issue is the issue of the day, and it's recognized to be the core of the conflict in the region. So we will never be forgotten. I can speak for myself. Until the events of the last 18 months, everything seemed to be stagnant. There was no progress. There was a cold peace with Egypt, cold peace with Jordan. And the events of the Arab Spring stirred everything up. And only if there is democracy will the people speak and influence their governments. And the people are, in all these countries, are supportive of the Palestinian cause. It's the governments which were following the cue from America and Israel. And they were supporting the Israeli borders, the Israeli policies, passively maybe, but still supporting the colonization of Palestine. And this will change. It doesn't mean that the change will come tomorrow. It will take time. Democracy takes time after oppression of decades. But at least now there is the beginning of a new path, which I hope and feel and strongly feel is a better path. It also was the destruction of psychological and physical barriers. And I write about a particular issue where in Nakba Day of 2011, the Syrians and Jordanians in Syria walked towards the border between Syria and Israel in the Golan Heights, the occupied Golan Heights. And the people on the occupied part were telling these youngsters, do not go any further because there are mines and you will get killed. The youngsters did not listen and continued and jumped over and got to the Israeli occupied part. Nothing happened to them. It turned out that for 4 decades, what people believed to be mine grounds that prevented them from crossing the border had no mines. It was just a psychological barrier that had been overcome, and it created a huge impact on all of us, and made us realize how much we have internalized borders in the Middle East that are artificial borders and have only become borders in the last 100 years, and now are believed to be real borders that are forever going to be there. They're not going to be there forever. Borders will be removed, and the Middle East will become a new region and a better region, to my mind.
Also interested in conflict is the lawyer and founder of the campaigning organisation Reprieve, which helps victims of miscarriages of justice all over the world. He's Clive Stafford Smith. First on his mind, when we asked him what he was thinking about, was a man who's been in an American prison since 1986.
First, we're in this fantastically sunny, lovely Edinburgh. And every time I'm living a very lovely life like that, I do feel very guilty about Chris, Maharaj and Marita. Because, you know, Chris tells me when I go see him in prison that remember him every night, that he's been 26 years now in prison for something he didn't do. And poor Marita, they're both 73 this year, and his wife has stuck by him for those 26 years through an awful, awful thing. You know, and that's why I wrote the book, was to get his story out into the public arena, because I've failed him in the court arena for so long, for 18 years. I'm pretty obsessed by that today. I'm obsessed by various things. The latest of our Reprieve things, the charity, you know, I run in theory, although it's really run by much more competent people, Reprieve in London. Our latest thing is drones in Waziristan in Pakistan. And I was just having lunch with Kenny McCaskill. I do love the Scots. I'm horribly prejudiced in favor of the Scots. And, you know, Kenny, I like a great deal. And we were just discussing that and what perhaps Scotland can do, because you're dealing with drones flying over Waziristan firing Hellfire missiles that people they refer to as bug splats, and these things are buzzing all over Waziristan the whole time. And I think one of the great indicators to me of what these people are suffering through is the number of anti-anxiety medications and antidepressants that are being prescribed to the people there because of what they're going through the whole time. So I was inviting Kenny, I'm not sure he'll make it, on our march to Mirren Shah, where Imran Khan and I are going to just go in there, because it's the only war zone on Earth where it's not really a war, of course, there's no war between Pakistan and America, but it's the only illegal war zone on Earth where no journalists go, and consequently no one knows the truth. And the Americans say that no innocent people are being killed. Well, I've met innocent people who have been killed there. I met them before they were killed. We had a meeting a year ago in Islamabad. 16-year-old kid called Tariq Aziz was there. I shook his hand. He wanted to know what he could do about the whole process because his family were getting killed. And 3 days later, the Americans killed him. And that made it very personal for me. So one of the things I've been obsessed with today is that. And it goes on and on, frankly.
But you're going over there to walk through that territory?
Yes. I mean, obviously it's dangerous, but I was promised by the local people that neither they nor the local Taliban will do us any harm. They said they couldn't answer for the Pakistan Army or the CIA. So Imran said he'd take care of the army. My job is the CIA. And this is what we're going to do, and I'll need your help on this. I'm going to write to Obama. Obama has a thing he calls the kill list, where once a week they have a PowerPoint display on men with beards that they want to kill in Waziristan this week. And he says, and this is stunning stuff, but it was in the paper the other day, before he decides who to kill, he says he read Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine, so he knew the right sort of people to kill. So I shall write to Obama and I say, look, I'm an American citizen as well as being British, and I'm going to be there on the 23rd of September, and dear President Obama, if my picture comes up on that, you know, kill list thing, please don't say yes. And I'm hoping that that way we can, we'll publish that in the papers, and I'm hoping that we can neutralize the desire to go firing missiles at us when we get there.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.